The end result has been the forced, limited earning power of Joe, preoccupying most of his time to make ends meet. Furthermore, Joe's remaining free time is spent in his studies towards self-knowledge. Luckily for Joe, he lives with a very qualified member of Alcoholics Anonymous who has been able to come to his aid and when all other methods have failed. Once again, please excuse Joe, knowing that he now has proper guidance. Best regards, Brendan Daly, the number one favorite sponsee. So what can I say? Right? Okay, come on in. That'll work. You can, so you can show up with, as long as you have an excuse letter, you can show up. So I don't know why I felt compelled to share that this morning. I just didn't want to miss that. That's just such a treasure to me, this letter now. It really is. And on the second step, we won't read a lot of what it says here, but there, you know, Bill writes in the second step that it's, you know, there's these things about the prosaic steel girder and that, you know, visual proof is the weakest kind. I mean, he really goes into it. And then he really ends up saying, you know, sometimes we're at odds as to really tell you why it's better to believe than not to believe. It's a difficult question. And there's a place where they say where when many thousands of men and women, can tell you that it's this power of God, it's the most important thing in their life. You know, it presents a powerful reason why one should have faith. And more than all of the stuff that it said in We Agnostics, that was the biggest thing for me, was that I had people in my life, and I said this last night, that I'm so happy that I got sober when I got sober and with the people that I got sober with, because I had these examples in my life of these people who were saying that their life was like this and now it's like this, and I believed them, and that this reason was that this belief they had in this power greater than themselves. My first step sponsor, the first guy that ever took me through this book the way that it's outlined here, and it was the facilitator of that very first workshop that I went to, invited me over to his house a lot. And he eventually ended up becoming my sponsor, and I did my first fist step with that guy. But he invited me to his place. He didn't have a car. He had this little tiny apartment down in Fremont in Seattle, and it was a real flop house. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, drugs. I mean, it was just a real cheap place. Had a little studio apartment in there. And then he cut mats for a living, these art mats, you know, that people frame art things with. And he had a job where he was selling these mats to this frame shop. So he had this big machine set up in a little studio apartment. I mean, there was his bed, there was this big machine that he would cut these mats out for framed art for different 12-inch, you know, all the way up to big ones. And he would stack these things up, and then he would take them down and sell them to these frame shops. He just had this life, and he was just beaming all the time. And he just told me one day, he just said, Kenny, you know, the sunlight of the Spirit shines in my life every day since I've been doing this work. And I just really wanted what this guy had. And he would bring people in off the streets all the time and let people use his place for showers. And there was always people crashing. I mean, this guy was absolutely on fire with this idea of working with others. And he helped hundreds of people. He doesn't live in the Seattle area anymore, but he's moved in. And actually, that little art thing he was working on ended up, he kind of parlayed that into a career, and he's, you know, a very successful artist now, and sells his own art, and somebody else is making mats for him now. But, you know, he had that deal, and that deal, that testimony, that presented the most powerful reason for me why I should have faith. And it's really about becoming open-minded in step two, this idea that I can look at step two from this place of knowing that that there are these things in my life, like I talked to you about with my parenting and my finances. There's things in my life, years sober, that I am still agnostic about. You know, agnostic is kind of not knowing. There's times when I don't really know, is God going to really step up to the plate here? If I, if I come out here to New Mexico to do this retreat, is God going to come with me? Kind of stuff. You know, that's agnosticism, pure and simple. And, you know, the deal One of the best stories that they talk about in here is this idea of being open-minded to the spiritual life. Like I talked about that guy that taught me about meditation. I don't discount anything that he says now. I mean, I haven't had that experience, but who am I to say that that what he wasn't talking about is real? And I have come to believe that we really do shortchange ourselves in the spiritual life. And the limited thing is my own closed-mindedness. That's what limits me from going further. And Jim and I talked this morning about that, you know, that we were talking at breakfast and Jim was telling me that, you know, he has a life today that he could never have even imagined in his wildest dreams. No matter how much I, you know, the biggest vision that I could possibly have had, I could never have had the life that I have today. You know, that came to me through open-mindedness and being exposed to a deeper and deeper level of living the spiritual life. And the thing that, one of the examples that I've thought of, and this has just come to me recently as well, is this example of that I was homeless as a teenager. I was homeless again, you know, off and on a couple times as an adult. And I remembered I had this one friend, and his mom had fixed up this garage. It was like a detached garage. But his mom had fixed up this garage for him, and he kind of had hung some blankets up and kind of turned it into a bedroom. And it was a really cool place because there was no parents around. You could do whatever you wanted out there in the garage. And you know, I used to walk by these houses, and I used to look, and I'd think, man, would that be something if those people would let me live in that garage? I'd put some blankets up. I'd hang some posters. Man, I could put some heat out there. That it'd be great if those people would let me live in that garage. And you know the thing, the amazing thing about it is I never saw the house. Isn't that something? That just came to me like just a year or two ago. I was thinking about that. I never saw the house. I never imagined in my, you know, my greatest wishes was that maybe somebody would let me live in their garage. That's where my mindset was. I never saw past that. I never saw maybe someday I'd have a house like this. And maybe God would have a bigger vision for me than that. That I would just that it was this limited vision that I have. And we agnostics is so much about that. So much about our limited vision where the spiritual life is concerned. That we are stuck on all kinds of fixed ideas and superstitions. And they use this example where they say that modern men, the men of today, are not any more intelligent than our ancestors. They you know, people have ways of looking at these things, and I don't know if I entirely agree with that, but they say, hey, they've looked back, you know, hundreds of years or even thousands of years in some cases and found that these people had really extremely smart mathematical minds and astronomical minds, and you know, they weren't. But what limited those people from making progress was, and this is out of the big book, this description, you know, Bill says that they're a little bit at odds, but here's a few reasons why we think it's better to believe and not to believe. And they said what really fettered these people was these superstitions that they had, that you can't do this or you can't do that or this is going to make the gods mad or that's going to. So they really, even though they had these great and wonderful ideas, they weren't really able to put it into a better spiritual life for themselves because they were stuck, and it stayed that way for a long time. And you know, there's these ideas that some of the greatest movements in mankind, and this is outside of the spiritual realm, but you know, one of the greatest things was fire. They said that really changed human beings forever. You know, the discovery of fire and the control of fire, that changed things forever. And then one of the big things was the wheel. You know, one of the really huge things was this industrial revolution, and that's what Bill was talking about. You know, his generation was right in the middle of that thing, the invention of airplanes. And they use a description here written in 1938, published in 39, that they use this description of ask any longshoreman on the street, and that just means just ask any regular guy, uneducated person, if you think that they can get to the moon by means of a rocket ship. And of course, they didn't get there for 30 years. I think it was 1968 before they actually got to the moon. This is 30 years before, and they're saying, oh yeah, the longshoremen would say, absolutely we can. Absolutely. And this is in the We Agnostics, is that, you know, Bill uses that description to show that what times were like, this industrial revolution that took place. We're currently in another one. They're saying that this current life that you and I are living now is another one of these huge jumps in mankind that will change the human race forever, and it's called the internet. This is this huge tool that we're kind of a part of watching this. Bill's deal was this industrial revolution, and it was typified by this open-mindedness of being able to throw away something old that doesn't work and accepting something new that does. And that's the, you know, and all these are analogies for the spiritual life, that we want to be able to throw away stuff in the spiritual life that doesn't work for something that does. And if you get stuck on something that becomes dry or it becomes stagnant, then this very thing that worked so well for you is now the thing that fetters you. And I believe, and maybe someone will look that up in this big book dictionary, but I believe that word fettered that they use in there, it's the ankle bracelets. Like they'll fetter a guy to a wall, you know, with an ankle bracelet and the other piece is, you know, tagged into a piece of cement. And that's the word they use. We're fettered by superstitions and fixed ideas of all kinds. And sober 17 years, I am fettered by superstitions and fixed ideas. And my current sponsor, you know, he told me to, like, put the big book away for a while. And he said, you know, you got to be able to blow through that spiritually. Like, get to the other side of what the real meanings are in that stuff. And look at this bigger picture. And it's been a really great experience for me to become open-minded, more open-minded in the spiritual life is better. You know, closed-minded in the spiritual life is fettered. And, you know, there's that idea of who am I to say there is no God? And that bigger picture is who am I to say that, you know, my God is the one and only God or better than your God? And I love that. You know, it's one of those perfect things about what we have here in AA is that I can take somebody through the steps, and I do have some deep spiritual convictions and ideas, but I can take people through the steps all the way, and I don't ever share any of that stuff with them. And that's the beautiful thing. That's how I know that I am anonymous in this process, because I will go through and these people will start coming up with this stuff on their own. And it wasn't from me. They just did it through writing inventory, doing the prayer and meditation. They start coming up with these beliefs and ideas. One of the very best analogies they give us in We Agnostics is they give us this analogy of the Wright brothers. And I just love that idea because the best mathematical minds of the times that these brothers lived at had proved that man could not fly. They'd proven it. They had, you know, big sheets and here's why, and they could write it all out and they could say, you know, this can't be done. So the men of science had firm convictions, can't be done. No use even wasting your time. And then the men of religion on the other side had looked at this deal pretty carefully about man flying, and they had decided that, you know, God has reserved this right for the birds. You know, human beings shouldn't be doing this stuff. So they were fettered by their fixed ideas. And the men of science, you know, these brilliant minds were fettered, and they said, hey, look at Professor Langley. His flying machine went to the bottom of the Potomac River, and that guy was brilliant. And if he can't do it, certainly, you know, our science is right. Man can't fly. The math is correct. So you had the men of science that said that they couldn't do it, proven it. You had the men of religion saying you can't do it. The Bible says so. It's a proven deal. Can't fly. But somebody forgot to tell these bicycle mechanics out in Kitty Hawk. Yeah, yeah. And it's the same thing. Somebody forgot to tell Kenny that you could have the big house and you don't have to be fettered by this idea of somebody will let you live in his garage. And the same thing with Jim, you know, that in my wildest dreams I couldn't imagine. And I absolutely believe that for me today, I'm probably have just barely scratched the surface. I've probably barely scratched the surface of what really, truly is available in the spiritual life. And that's really the gist of the second step, is just be open-minded enough to admit that maybe there is something there. They go in the second step. They take a pretty big leap here in We Agnostics from, I think it's 46. Let me just get a page number here for you. From 47, excuse me. They bring us to this deal we call the second step question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing? There's that willingness we talked about. To believe that there is a power greater than myself. That's the second step question. We kind of talk to people about this. They give us some of these descriptions. Hey, all you got to do is be willing. That's all they say, is just be willing. They say this is great news for us. And they say before that, they say it's been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. So just that cornerstone of willingness is really all you need here. But then they take us up a few pages more. To page 53. So 6 pages later, they're saying in one hand, they say, yeah, all you need is willingness. And then they bring us up 6 pages later in step 53, and it's something we need to rectify. And they say, when we became alcoholics crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And that's a lot harder terms than, hey, all you got to do is be willing, isn't it? 6 pages later, and it's, you know, I warn people. I tell them, you know, this book will back you into a corner where your spiritual beliefs are concerned. So you have to start asking yourself, what is it that I believe? You know, what is it that I really believe? Because they come up and they say, hey, we're in this self-imposed crisis, which is step one. You know, that we've finally come to a place where we cannot any longer postpone or evade the question of God is either everything or he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. And I looked at this at one time as only one question. God either is everything or he's nothing. I'd kind of back my sponsees into the God is everything corner. And I've really come to look at this in a different way, because it's not the only choice. There's really 4 choices there. God is everything, or God is nothing. And if that doesn't work for you, they say you can go to the God is or God isn't deal too. If the God is everything question is too much for you, you can go this other route and just say that God is. And of course, when we're speaking about God, we're always speaking about your own conception of God. It tells us in here we don't even need to consider another's conception. Don't even need to consider it. And so the God is question is a question that can be answered as we're going through these steps. And it's a question that needs to be answered. God is everything or he's nothing. And you can look at God is everything, and it is God is everything that I live and move and have my being in God. That's a common idea, that there is nothing that is not God. God is everything can mean God is everything to me, because without God, I am nothing. You know, I will destroy myself without this power greater than myself. And if any of those ideas are too much, you can just go with just the God is. But any of those answers is enough to really propel you into this idea of making a decision to turn our will and our life over to God. I don't talk about the 12 and 12 a lot when I do these workshops. It'd be kind of another deal to go through the 12 and 12. But I've been attracted to it more and more the longer I'm sober. And one of the things that, you know, Bill was 3.5 years sober when he said this, when he wrote this. And he was 20 years sober when he wrote the 12 and 12. And he had some new experiences. And one of the experiences that he shares with us in step two in the 12 and 12, he shares this idea that he said that, and I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, he uses the analogy of the sponsor talking. He says, well, maybe we can imagine the sponsor talking to the sponsee having this conversation. Then there's this little conversation in the 12 and 12. And he says that there was a guy who was the vice president of the American Atheist Association, who was one of our members. And it said that, and the bottom line here is what Bill ends up saying is, he says this hoop that we have to jump through, In step two, he made the hoop kind of God is everything or God is nothing in the big book. In the 12 and 12, he said, at 20 years sober, he said, you know, this hoop that we have to jump through in step two is bigger than we ever imagined. It's bigger than we ever imagined. I just love that idea. It's one of the things that I really loved about that it isn't a small little thing that we need to get through. Once in a while, I'll quote scripture or something, not because I'm endorsing any, just because it's, you know, part of my experience. And then usually when I do, I'm wrong about it. And then somebody that actually knows what they're talking about will come up to me afterwards and say, well, Kenny, that's not exactly what they were talking about then. And that was one of the misconceptions I had. There was this idea that it was harder for a person to get to heaven than it was to go through the eye of a needle. And you know, that was kind of this old conception. And now Bill's talking about this hoop is bigger than we ever imagined that we can jump through in step two. The only thing really requires is willingness. And then, of course, somebody set me straight on that. And they said, well, that's not really what it says. What it says is harder for a rich man to get through an eye of a needle than it is to gain access to heaven. So and the idea there is the needle was like the, you know, in the towns in those days, they would build these gates around these cities, and then they would have a needle. And the needle, once the gate was closed, you'd have to go through the needle at night, and the needle meant you had to leave all your stuff behind. You have to leave your camel and all your crap behind. Well, rich guys didn't want to do that. It's harder for them. And that's the idea in the spiritual life. It was just it's a spiritual axiom that, you know, if I'm going to go through this, I got to leave everything behind, everything that I think I know about God, these steps, the disease of alcoholism. I have to leave that stuff behind. That's the idea there of that. It really isn't a description of that it's really difficult to get to heaven. It's difficult if I want to try to bring all of my stuff with me. It's going to be a little hard. And that's really what the steps are about. The steps are specifically designed to bring us to a place where we can have the spiritual awakening as a result of this. The steps force us to leave behind our resentments and our fear and to go back into our past and to set all of these things right. So with that, let's turn to, I know we're moving kind of quickly, but I want to do this. Let's turn to how it works to page 60. This is the description of the actor trying to play the director. So they say we got a little belief in God, and let's now look at our life, you know, with this belief that we have in this power greater than ourselves, the actor and the director. And the actor and the director in my life, even 17 years sober, I look at all of these areas where I, you know, it is the actor playing the director. That deal with my daughter is definitely, you know, an actor who's, you know, I'm here to play a role that God assigns. And the craziest thing about this whole thing, we won't go into all of it, but that they say on top of page 61, everybody, including himself, would be pleased. So that's the insane thing about this, is that I'm not only convinced I know what's best for me, but I'm convinced I know what's best for everybody else. I know what's best for AA. I know what's best for these people at work. I know what's best for everybody in my family. And it just drives people nuts. It just drives people completely bananas that I do this. And of course, it says what usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. And that's usually one of those things, whether you're going through the steps for the first time or you're going through the steps again, that will bring you back into a third step and to start writing inventory again, is the show's not coming off very well. The Kenny show is like, you know, going to close on opening night. I mean, this deal's going to go down in flames. And you know, that, and it's that deal of being convinced that I know what's best for somebody else. That is really behind this. I know what's best for me. I know what's best for everybody else. If everybody will just be quiet and just kind of go along with my plan here, you know, and it says in your life will be wonderful. Everybody's going to be pleased. I become convinced of that. So we come over on page 63. And we'll talk about the third step a little bit. When we come back in, we're going to do a little longer meditation. And we'll do a third step prayer as a group. And we'll for those of you that want to. And this is only voluntary. And don't feel bad at all. If you don't feel like praying, you don't feel like holding hands. My friend Mike in Seattle has a really great story. He said that he was doing a third step. His first third step was with a group, and they lit a candle and they turned the lights down and they played some soft music, and he's holding hands with everybody, and he's thinking in his mind, he's a new guy thinking. He's thinking, I don't know what I got myself into. So I don't know if we're getting ready to pray or if we're getting ready to have sex here, he says to himself. Because they had all this mood music and everything. So but if that, if lighting candles and music and prayer, if you're not comfortable with that, coming back in for the next section, you can stand and watch and do that with your sponsor when the time comes. So we don't want to make this uncomfortable for anybody. That's certainly not what we're trying to do here this weekend. We're going to do this third step then so we can get that behind us and get to talking about steps 4 and 5, the inventory a little bit, and move on to amends. And we're going to spend a good chunk of the time we have here this weekend on 10, 11, and 12. So a few ideas about the third step prayer. Are most people here, if most people have done this third step prayer before? I think so, with this group.
We end our group with
And AA group ends with this prayer. Good, good. So that's great. The idea here is that, and it's an idea that I've really got comfortable with, and I like to clarify to people, like, make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. And what does that really mean? It seems like a big task. And it's one of these things that are so perfect about the 12th step, because I had spiritual experiences, or I had spiritual experiences that were valid experiences, but they were these experiences that kind of ended with that. And here in AA, this is where it kind of begins. You know, these experiences ended with turning my life over to God and saying a few prayers, and then I was going to, miraculously everything was going to be fine. And I was in really bad shape at one time. They had this big thing called the Harvest Crusade at Memorial Coliseum, and I went down to the Harvest Crusade, and they had this very famous preacher that was there, and he was from California, and he was doing the whole deal, and the stadium was packed, and somebody told me about it. They were handing out stuff on the streets. They said, "Yeah, you ought to come." Well, I went in there and I went up and I kind of did a third step and in their fashion. And some people talked to me, and man, I had a valid experience with that. It was really, a really nice deal. But at the end of the night, Memorial Stadium was empty, and I was back doing drugs, within a few hours, actually, of that experience. And I never followed through or called. They gave me phone numbers, and I'm not saying anything was wrong with that. But in AA, we have this deal where we make this decision to turn our will in our lives. It's not the action of that. So what am I really deciding when I do this prayer? The decision is to work steps 4 through 9. That is the action of turning my will and my life over to the care of God. That is my experience. My experience is that when I wrote inventory and when I admitted all of these defects of characters and these faults and went through that inventory process in 5 and came out of that experience in 6 and 7 and asked God to remove those things and made that 8-step list and went out and repaired the damage done in the past in the 9th step, that I felt this presence of God coming in. And after 5, that's the promise. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs up to this point, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The spiritual experience actually begins after 5. It doesn't begin after 3. 3 is a decision. And I had an experience in sobriety when these guys were kind of scouring the halls, and once in a while I'd break down in tears. That was one of them. I was desperate, and I was asking this guy how to meditate, and I really was just doing everything I could to find an answer. And I thought, well, maybe if I did a third step and I read the third step out of the 12 and 12 and I kind of did the best third step I could, and Al, the car lot guy, and I sat out there and we read the third step out of the 12 and 12 and we did a serenity prayer. And I felt really elated, and like a week later I like broke a bunch of furniture and the deal, and I went to a meeting and I had lost my key and I couldn't get in. And it just sent me through the roof, and I just kicked the door and broke, shattered a bunch of stuff, and just went totally nuts. And, And this was like right after, you know, a few days after I'd had this great third step experience, and I was talking about this, and one of these step guys, you know, brought me to this part of the book and showed me that, you know, where it says next we launched. And, well, what did you do after you did the third step? And it was one of those things that really hooked me into going down and doing this workshop, that I thought maybe these guys had a little more something to it. And so this third step we'll be doing is just a decision. It's a decision to practice steps 4 through 9 and then to live in this new way of life in 10, 11, and 12. And that's the real decision in 3, I think. I really don't think there's anything more to it than that. I think it really is just kind of this commitment to go forward. And as we do those steps, we are brought into this new way of living. So I think everybody's probably got a little coffee in them this morning and probably would like a break. So it's almost 10 after 10, and I will turn the recorder off. We'll take care of any housekeeping issues, and we'll take a break. So thank you. Okay, welcome back, everybody. We're here getting in preparation for our third step. We'll talk for just a couple of minutes first, and then we will circle up. And I'm glad we've got this circle here. A good friend of mine who's a non-alcoholic, but he's an artist, and I've got a couple of his paintings in my house. And he's just a really, he's a really spiritual guy, a guy I really admire. And his mother wrote a book called Ceremonial Circles. And she's passed away now, but she was a very popular author, and her name was Sidonia Cahill, and she wrote a lot of books, but she wrote a whole book about just this, a whole book, a couple hundred pages, about people circling up all over the world. This is what spiritual people do, is they form circles and share with each other. So I always prefer this, you know, in a group, if we can. You know, even at my home group, which we have a couple hundred people at my home group, we always try to set up the chairs so that there isn't like, a hierarchy. We try to form as big a circle as we can, so it's kind of circles with other circles around them and aisles and stuff. But we try to kind of use that idea that there is a power in forming the circle. So we've done that. We've formed a circle. Somebody joked that it was a... not the circle of love, but the oval of love. So a couple of things that I'll share a little bit about my, you know, I had a couple of different third step experiences. I had this third step experience, which was very huge, and I had a very great spiritual experience around it, but it never amounted to a solution for alcoholism. You know, it was just kind of this third step experience, and I went after the third step. We read that piece out of the 12 and 12, and I actually was left quite empty afterwards. I had a huge spiritual experience. I mean, I just felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders. I remember laying on my bed back in my little apartment and just, you know, I didn't want to fall asleep because I was just felt so great after doing that. I really felt like something had happened, and then shortly afterward, I was just as crazy as ever. Somebody between the sessions had asked me, you know, about the difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. And I don't think we need to get into too much detail there, but there is a difference between having a spiritual experience and recovery from alcoholism. You know, they talk in the end of the big book, in the section on the spiritual experience, they talk about this. You know, it was an experience sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism, is what they're talking about when they use those terms in the big book, spiritual experience and spiritual awakening. You know, it says those terms are used many times. What they're really talking about is a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And so what they mean by that is that, and I said I wasn't going to get into that very much, but it's a couple things just occurred to me. But what they really mean by that is that what does a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening is really more what we're talking about here. What is a spiritual awakening? What is it? Well, from the outside, it looks like a personality change. That's what it looks like from the outside. And I guarantee you that my personality has changed in every conceivable manner since I got sober. I am just a completely, you know, the person that came into the program doesn't really even exist. And quite truthfully, I have to get quiet today, and I have to get prayerful today to really remember what it was like to be a drunk. That's how far, you know, to really remember that. It takes these weekends, you know, and some time in prayer, because my life is so unlike that. I've had this huge personality change. They say that the essence of that, which means what it feels like on the inside, is this, you know, they say some of our members call it this God consciousness. It's the awareness of the presence of God. That's what a spiritual awakening feels like, is that I am aware of the presence of God in my life. Like my friend Jeffrey said, you know, the sunlight of the Spirit shines on my life every day, he said. And man, I really wanted what that guy had. So the first time I really started getting into this book, we did this third step. We were kind of coming up on this third step in my group, in my workshop that I was doing, and a couple things happened. I'll tell you a couple of funny stories here. And there was that guy that was named Patrick. He was one day sober less than I was, and Patrick and I were going to go up the mountain and do this third step, but we'd had some really bizarre experiences with the workshop. You know, like I said, we were kind of going to the workshop every Tuesday, and then after the workshop, we'd kind of deprogram each other and tell each other, yeah, that guy's a nut, and this guy's, you know, trying to impress the chicks, and these guys, you know, he talks about spirituality, but I seen him with that newcomer, and, you know, I mean, we just really hammered these guys, but every Tuesday, we were back at the workshop again, you know, with our highlighters and our pens and everything, but Patrick had called me. We were getting up to the third step, and Patrick had called me one night. He was at this boarding house. I was back in that back room at the car lot, and he called me, and he said, Kenny, I don't know what's going on, but he said, I had this spiritual experience of some kind. He said, I was just laying on my bed, and all this wind started coming out of my body, and I just felt like I'd been purged, and I wonder if that has to do with these prayers, you know, that we're doing in the workshop and this stuff about the third step. And like I said last night, you know, Patrick was right off the skids. I mean, this guy was right off the streets. So, you know, being one day sober more than him, you know, I had to kind of try to help put this deal into perspective for him. So I told him, I said, well, let's think about this, Patrick. You know, what's going on here? Let's kind of break this thing down a little bit. Because I'm thinking in my mind, Patrick's going nuts, and I got to talk him down here. And so I was talking to him a little bit, and this was the night, you know, this was a late on a Tuesday night after the workshop. And I said, we finally got done. I said, Patrick, did you drink the coffee at the workshop? And he said, well, yeah, he's had a couple cups of coffee. And I said, well, Patrick, I didn't drink any coffee at the workshop, and I didn't have any such experience. So obviously what we've got here is we've come across a group of people who are forming a cult within Alcoholics Anonymous, and these guys are putting drugs in the coffee to try to, and so, you know, we got to be careful here, because we could, and I was, you know, the crazy thing about it, and this is really where my mindset was, the crazy thing about it was that for one, I didn't totally believe that. You know, I was trying to kind of put this into, trying to figure out what happened with Patrick, and he was truly kind of freaking out, and so, you know, this idea that maybe somebody had put some drugs in the coffee was the deal. And still today in AA, there's those people I told you about that are still very close to me that finished that workshop and are still in my life today. And they still tease me about that. They still will see me and say, oh, Kenny, I'd watch out about that coffee. You know, they think it's really a big joke around in my home group about, you know, Kenny and watch out for the coffee. And because I did, you know, I went back to the workshop and I would tell people, I'd say, and that's the amazing thing about it, was actually in my mind, there was a part of me that believed that this could be possible. It could be possible that we were involved with some kind of a cult within Alcoholics Anonymous, and that these people were putting drugs in the coffee. And then there was this other deal where they had planned to bring this big guru up from California, and we were all going to do this retreat up in the mountains, and we would all do our third step together like we're getting ready to prepare here. So I was thinking, boy, this is trouble. And these, you know, these guys are after my earthly possessions, remembering, you know, not remembering that I'm, you know, by living by the grace of my sponsor in the back of a car lot, I wasn't exactly a prime target. So, But, you know, the thing about that was that I continued to go to that workshop. And I would tell people, I would say, hey, I'd watch out for that coffee there. You know, Patrick here had a hell of an experience on that stuff a couple nights ago. And I'd be careful. But they said they were going to do this deal. We were going to go up in the mountains. We'd do this retreat. They were going to do you know, they were bringing this guy up from California. And he was going to take us all up to the book, up to the third step. And then we'd do a third step prayer together up there. And then the idea was everybody from the workshop would start writing inventory at this retreat. And so Patrick and I, you know, people were offering us rides. I had just got a car, and it was a car that I got from my sponsor. And it was a $100 car, and that was off a car lot. It was out the door, tax and license included, $100. So you can imagine what kind of a car this was. It had completely bald tires, and it had this huge transmission fluid leak, so that if I parked it just wrong, it would, you know, if I parked it on the hill, all the transmission fluid would leak out of the sink. So I had to be real careful how I parked it. And transmission fluid was expensive, so I couldn't, you know, I had to be really try to figure out ways to catch the transmission fluid. And you know, it was really a piece of junk car. So Patrick said, well, my sister, and we weren't about to take a ride with any of these nuts up to the, because we wanted to be able to get out of there if things kind of took a turn for the worse. And Patrick said, well, I got a car. And Patrick at one time had kind of had this car, and he was this dope fiend that would go into bars, and this was his game. He'd go into bars, and he'd let people use his car for doing drugs. But the thing about his car was that it was up on blocks. It didn't run and everything. And he'd say, so he'd bring people out. His car was parked behind this tavern. He'd bring people out there and say, yeah, come on, he'd use my car. People would be like, oh, this car had no tires on it, you know. And, you know, he'd sold everything he possibly could off this car. But the car had been rescued, and they'd got some wheels on it, and it had been over at his sister's house. And he said, well, I got a car over at my sister's house, and I think it probably just needs like a starter or something. So we went over, and we sized it up, and the grass had kind of grown up all around this car. And we were thinking, oh, yeah, this is a much better choice than my ride, for sure. So we'll fix this thing up, and we did. We got air in the tires. We got it back and forth, did all this work on it, and we were going to take his ride up the mountain. And it was up over Snoqualmie Pass, which is one of the big passes coming out of Seattle. I don't think it's this elevation, but is it like 6,000 feet or something, 7,000 feet? Huh? Three. There you go. Yeah, okay. So, yeah. I asked Niles because he's a skier, and he skied all over Washington State. So it's about 3,000 feet, but you're coming from sea level, too. That's something to remember, too. You're coming from sea level straight up 3,000 feet, so it's a bit of a climb. Well, his car had this overheating problem. So we would drive a little bit, and we're thinking, hey, we're going up to do this third step. We're going to meet this big guru from California, and we're going to go up and do this deal. We're going to find God, me and you together, dude. And let's go. And we had this back seat that was filled with these big jugs of water so that we could drive a little ways up the Snoqualmie Pass, and we had to pull over and let the car cool down, and we'd have to add water, and then we could drive a little ways. And people from the retreat were headed up, and they would see us, and they would stop. Hey, you guys all right? And we'd say, oh, yeah, no problem. We're fine. Well, geez, what's the deal with all the water in the back seat? Oh, we got a little overheating problem, but we're going to be all right. You know? And we were, you know, trying to just make sure we had our escape plan. And we were going up, and we said, Patrick, let's really try this prayer deal. And I sat with Patrick, and the two of us said a prayer in his car together. God, please help us to get up this mountain. We really need to get up to this third step. And we really, you know, we really want to be done with drinking and using drugs. And, you know, do everything you can to help us here. And then we started up. We went a little ways. And then we saw this bus that was broke down on the side of the road. And all the people were out of the bus, and the hood on the bus was up. And on the side of the bus, it said, The Church of God on the side of this bus. And I said to Patrick, if he's not getting those guys up this mountain, you know, we're in some serious trouble here. That prayer we said, you know, those guys had a much better chance, I think, than we do. That wasn't just any church there. You know, that is the Church of God. You know, that's the top level as far as I know. So that was really my experience was, and we got up to this retreat. It was a, you know, we were crazier than hell. It was a silent retreat for the first day. The first day we did a couple of sessions, and then it was silent until the next morning. And that just, you know, was way over the top for me. And I had way too much on my mind and couldn't talk to anybody. And I just quit smoking a couple days before that. I was like, well, I'm going to do this third step. And yeah, it was really a wild deal. So I came into that third step that way, but I did a third step in a group just like this. And I had a really great experience. And a lot of people that were at that retreat are still my good friends today. And I followed through, wrote the inventory. And of course, I'll share a lot more about, you know, how I got from that insanity to this place where I'm here with you folks in New Mexico this weekend as we go more through the steps. But, you know, I just say that and I tell those stories because, you know, my experience was that I didn't really need to bite this deal off. You know, I was able to, looking back on it now, I really see that I kind of took the second, third step, maybe more piecemeal than I would have thought at the time. Of course, at the time, I was God is everything and I'm committed and doing my third step, but really there was a lot of reservations. You know, we weren't going to ride with anybody else. We weren't going to take anybody else's car. We were maybe, if it got crazy, we were going to leave and maybe there's stuff going on. I mean, I had a lot of reservations, but also somebody asked me, you know, read this letter that I wrote, and somebody asked me about the guy that wrote that letter, what's going on with him, and his name is Joe, and I just wanted to report to everybody, I didn't follow through with that, but he has, or not the guy that wrote the letter, but the guy that, this guy that brought the letter that had the excuse letter that was coming to my house is Joe Kay, and he's sober over 2 years now, about 2.5 years, and he's working with 3 or 4 guys, and he's sponsoring people, and he's a huge part of our home group, and he's just doing amazing, you know, he's just really doing amazing things. So he did as well, finished his inventory and did his fifth step, and you know, got a lot of freedom. So, and this was coming from a guy, and I'm sure he would be okay with me sharing. This is coming from a guy, and he talks about this in his talks a lot now. He, you know, this is coming from a guy. This guy that brought this letter, you know, he was a guy that could not look himself in the mirror. That's part of his story. He could not look in the mirror when he got sober. And, you know, he came to my house before he brought this letter. In the first few times we met, he came to my house, and he told me, he said, I hate to tell you this, but you're wasting your time. So, and I told him, well, not actually quite to the contrary, but, you know, this, you're saving my life here, and I'd really appreciate it if you could keep showing up. He really believed that. He believed for him there was no hope. And this is a guy that was in and out of the program for 10 or 12 years, in and out and in and out and in and out. Absolutely could not stay sober, no matter what. And he'd been through a lot of different sponsors and different groups and different things and tried everything available to him, but never really had been exposed to this really solid step message until then. So, with that, we are going to do a meditation here. This meditation will maybe last about 15 minutes, so we'll just get comfortable. We'll use some of that meditation techniques if you need to that we talked about earlier. This will be a led meditation. It'll be a little different than the silent meditation. I think we will go ahead and keep the tape rolling. And I was joking with Dave. I was calling him the taper, and he said, "Well, it's not really a taper anymore because you don't really make tapes; you make the CDs." So now I'm calling him the burner. So, Dave the burner. We hope we've coined a new phrase here in AA. So, Dave the burner. We'll keep the burning going during this. It'll be a little led meditation. We'll start with a couple minutes of silence, and I'll just remind people to relax. And I like to tell people where we're going to go in these meditations. It's helpful. So this meditation is a meditation that I call the quiet place. And really all it is it's just trying to take us in our mind's eye to a place where we've been felt perfect ease and comfort. Could be a place from our past, our childhood. A woman I know, you know, her quiet place is a couch at an old retreat place where she's been going to these AA retreats for years. And some people don't have a place where they've ever felt like that. So that you can be a place that you imagine, a mountain stream or some, you know, in a kayak out in the water or some quiet place. And the object of this meditation isn't to be perfect. So if your mind wanders and you hear sounds and stuff, just remind yourself, oh, yeah, that's those people outside, and come back to the meditation when you hear my voice. And try to return yourself as much as you can to this idea, and we'll go there. I'll remind you, okay, now we're going to go to the quiet place, and we're going to go to the quiet place. We're going to try to find that in our mind's eye, just kind of use our mind's eye, our imagination, our and try to just go within a little bit, and then we're going to bring into the quiet place this idea of the third step, and they give us that on the bottom of page 62. It says, you know, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. We're going to bring some of those ideas of the third step into the quiet place with us. And so we're going to have this third step idea in the quiet place with us. And then we're going to let this third step idea move from our minds down into our hearts in the quiet place. Then we're going to come out of the quiet place and we're going to come back to the here and now, and we're going to bring this third step idea with us. And then we're going to sit, circle up as a group like we've done now. We'll hold hands and I'll lead us in the third step prayer. Well, I won't lead us. We're going to recite the third step prayer as a group together. So that will be our plan. If any time during this you get uncomfortable, you want to get up and stretch or walk, just remember this is a practice. And hopefully it's something that everybody can take with them. You know, people probably, a lot of people here have these kind of practice. And if you do, you can take this if it's something useful. If you don't, this is a good practice that you can take with you. I do this one-on-one with all the guys that I sponsor when we're getting ready to do a third step. You know, all it says, we thought well before taking this step is the words after this prayer. And so I always bring people up to this third step. That we took a break here today. I at least bring them up to the third step. And then I'll usually send them home to kind of consider it. And they'll come back the next week. And they know all about that. If you show up, you know, that week, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do some meditation. And we're going to do some quiet time. We're going to go to our quiet place. We're going to do the third step prayer together. And I tell them, bring a pen and paper, because we're going to start writing inventory as soon as we're done. So with that, we will just get quiet. I'm going to play a little music here. And I'll try to, you may hear me get up in the meditation if that happens. It's just because the music is too loud or too quiet, and I'll adjust the volume here a little bit. But so we'll just start by getting quiet. We'll start by relaxing and just kind of finding our seat, taking some deep breaths in and out. And just relaxing our body and bringing about a calmness of mind. And as we notice, any time during the meditation that our mind is wandering, we don't worry about it. We don't put any energy into it. We just realize that our mind has wandered. And whenever possible, we just return ourselves to the meditation, to this idea that we're going to be going to a quiet place. Just begin to get quiet and just concentrate on our breathing. We get quiet, we just relax and bring our attention to this meditation, to our breathing. We can use a mantra, a focal point to remind us that we're in meditation. All of the thoughts of the pressures and the troubles and the difficulties in our lives we're leaving behind. Or begin to imagine in our mind's eye, to envision a place where we've been at perfect peace and ease. A place maybe from the past, or a place from our future, a place where we would maybe like to be. Just the serene and calm surroundings. going quietly to our quiet place. Any distractions, we just return our thoughts to our quiet place. Let's begin to further and further envision ourselves in that place of serenity, in that place where we have a feeling that life is good. Feel the warmth of the Spirit. We know we're safe and protected. In our quiet place, and we just relax and let go of any distractions. And we begin to bring in a few ideas into the quiet place that we can consider here before we do our third step, that in our quiet place we bring in this ideas that hereafter in this drama of life that God will be the director, that we're here to play the role that He assigns. God is the principal and we are the agents. That we are here to be the agents and act on the principal's behalf in the best interest of the principal. God is the principal and we are the agents. God is the Father and we are the children. We take these simple ideas, bring these ideas into our consciousness and into our quiet place. We just continue to relax and bring ourselves back to the quiet place. Relax us in our quiet place. We just know that we're in the presence of God, that we're safe and protected. We're fully at peace and ease. And we consider this third step, this decision we're going to make to turn our will and our lives over to this power greater than ourselves. This decision that we're making to follow through with this process of these 12 steps. Decision to write inventory, admit our faults. Ask God to remove those things in our lives that we admit are objectionable. To make this list, to go out into the future and repair the damage done in the past to the best of our ability, and to live this new way of life in steps 10, 11, and 12. The action of turning our will and our lives over to the care of God. We bring these ideas into our quiet place with us. We now begin to allow these ideas here in this quiet place to move from our intellect, from our minds, to deep down in our hearts. Allow this decision to become a part of who we are. And any distractions that we have, we just recognize them and return to the quiet place. Allowing these ideas, this third step decision, to move into our, from our minds to deep down in our hearts. We relax and concentrate on our breathing and our quiet place, allowing that to be our focal point. knowing that life is good. Feel comfortable in this quiet place, knowing that this is a place that we can return to time after time, in times of difficulty or in times when we seek answers and looking for the ability to make decisions, that this quiet place is a place that we can go. That we can return to the quiet place whenever we'd like. And if for now we prepare to bring ourselves back to the here and now, and we bring with us this decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand God. And we begin to bring ourselves back to the here and now, and we don't leave the quiet place entirely, but we bring the peace and the serenity with us. We bring this decision that we've made in step three with us, this decision to make the third step, knowing that we've thought well before taking this step, that we're fully prepared to go forward. We ask for God's care and protection, and for those of you that wish, you can join me in the third step prayer. For those of you that need to, you can get put your books in front of you. We will recite the third step prayer together. God,
I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will.
Take away my difficulties, that victory over them
may bear witness to those I would help. Thy power, Thy love, Thy way of life, and do Thy will always.
Okay. Whew. Thanks, everybody.
What?
We'll take just a minute just to process what we've done here. But not a lot more than that. Well, the reason is, if you look at the next few lines in the book after the third step, they tell us that you know, this experience that we've had here will have little permanent effect unless at once, you know, it's less at once followed by this strenuous effort to face and be rid of those things that blocked us. And the analogy that I love to use is the analogy of, you know, the sunlight of the Spirit. I really love that description, because if I have these things in my life that are blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit, what would happen if those things were removed in my life? You know, that's a powerful idea, isn't it? That if those things that are blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit are removed, which is the idea of the 12 steps. That's the purpose of what we're doing here, is to remove those things that block us from the sunlight of the Spirit. Then I will know the presence of God in my life. And that was an incredibly powerful idea for me. It still is. That there are still things in my life that block and separate me from the presence of God. And if those things are removed, that I will know God at even a deeper level. That I will have, you know, I can again have this experience from where I'm at now that Jim was talking about earlier, that experience of I could never even imagine, you know, that is possible for me now at 17 years sober, just the same as it was then. It's just at a little different level now. This idea of the quiet place, if you found a quiet place, that's really great. I would caution you a little bit. It's one of those things, it's a little personal for me. And it's not just me. I mean, there's spiritual ideas behind this that go back a long ways. But some of these things you kind of want to keep to yourself. And I have shared my quiet place with a few people. I think I've shared it with my wife. I've shared a few people along the way. There's been a few people that were just genuinely interested, and they want to know, and I don't have really mind. But the reason is it's kind of a sacred thing. If you haven't found a quiet place, you can use this meditation. Somebody gave it to me, and now I give it to all of you. It's a way to kind of go into meditation and find a quiet place. And the nicest thing about that is, you know, Don shared his quiet place a lot with us, didn't he? You know, talked about that a lot in the going to the garden. And you know, I know that when the shit hits the fan, I was looking for another word, but when the shit hits the fan, I know where I'm going. I know where I do go today. When I have things that face me and I need to make a decision in my life, and Tom I says this, and I just love it. You know, Tom says that it's not decision that's difficult; it's indecision. When I'm faced with indecision, I go to my quiet place. That's where I look for the answers to my life's problems now. And so it's a really great tool that we can use in sobriety, this idea of going to our quiet place. If we have time, I'll share another meditation on Sunday morning with everybody that's a similar deal but takes us even a little further. And I'll share that with you Sunday. So the idea in the fourth step, and I've actually, to tell you the truth, I struggled a little bit with how to prepare for steps four and five here. And I'm not going to give specific instructions on inventory here. You know, I want you to get your specific instructions on inventory from your sponsors. Because things, little nuances and things, you can get caught up in the letter of the law here, and it really distracts us from what we want to do as a group for this weekend. And so I'm going to purposefully leave some of the finer definitions on right in inventory. And the reason that's come to me is I think you have a good array of fine sponsorship here in this group that can show you how to write inventory. And the book is very good at showing you how to write inventory as well. So I'll share some of my experience with inventory. We will look at the book a little bit. But the big book really deals with, and they use words like this to bring us to where we're at now. They've used words like next we launched, and I kind of have to like figure out, it's like the launch is, and that's the very next word after, you know, there's one paragraph after that, the third step prayer, what we just read, and then it says next we launch. So you got one paragraph, then it says launch. And that paragraph before that, you know, when I think about a launch, I think about the 10, 9, 8. You know, these guys are getting ready to go somewhere. They're not, you know, they don't want to scrub once you get down to the countdown, you know, this is next we launch. So they're like at that place of, okay, one, next we launch. We're going somewhere now. We don't wait and try to decipher, well, did I get a really, they said sometimes an effect, a very great one, is felt at once. And we saw that here. You know, I think that several people had a pretty nice experience in that third step, but it's not going to be anything that's a lasting deal. It says unless we launch, we have to follow this with the strenuous effort. So I was told when we did this inventory, they told us to bring a pen and paper, and I actually started writing my first inventory. The first thing they told me was to make this long list of all the people in my lives that I had resentments against, anybody with whom I had been angry. Maybe I wasn't angry with them at that moment because I was feeling pretty good, but had I been angry with these people, they should be on the list. And I followed through with that experience, and they asked me to list my fears, and they gave me a format for looking at my fears and why I had them, and for looking at why did self-reliance fail me. And there's some great examples of of inventory in the book. You know, there's one here. I will talk about one resentment that's in the book. We're not going to get caught up too much, but on 60-65, there's a beautiful resentment. I just love it. It's just so juicy. And it's called Mr. Brown. He's using this three-column format, and there's actually four columns to the inventory. They don't show it here because they tell you that, you know, once we get this much done that they show us, they tell us that we set that aside completely, what the other person did or what, and look at our part. And that's why that fourth column isn't showing here, because we've set it aside when we write fourth column. But this is just an example of a great resentment for a drunk. I just love this, that Bill came up with this. I wondered if it wasn't a little bit of personal experience. Mr. Brown, he's mad at Mr. Brown for three different reasons in that second column. His attention to my wife. This is a guy that's got his act together and starting to talk to his wife. Not only that, but he says, look at the next one. Told my wife of my mistress. God, I mean, this is number one on the list. This guy's paying attention to his wife, and by the way, he's, you know, I just feel compelled to tell you this. I would never treat you that way, right? I would never treat you this way. And you just seem like such a great woman to me. And you know, your husband is actually with so-and-so at the office. And you know, I just have to, as a friend, I feel compelled to, you know, tells the wife of the mistress. I would never do that. I can't believe that he's, you know, doesn't see what a beautiful person you are. And told my wife and my mistress, he's paying attention. And then the best, then to top it all off, Brown may get my job at the office. Right? So on top of all this, he's got this whole deal going on. Then he goes to the office and they're saying, hey, did you hear that Brown's up for the big promotion, you know? Right? And he's like, oh, God. And they say in there a few paragraphs before this example, they say that you can imagine the power that this would have in a person's life who's trying to get sober. And we all have a Mr. Brown. We all have a Mr. I had a list of 120 Mr. Browns. And I was angry at everybody and everything. And that's not, I mean, I don't know if that's where I'd classify that on the examples. I've had people come to me with lists, you know, short. We're not looking at volume here, but just to get it all down on paper and not to leave anything out. The paragraph before Mr. Brown said, resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. And that was news to me. Because I kind of thought maybe alcohol killed more alcoholics than anything else. It's a powerful deal. This resentment, and I'm not saying that this was in Bill's life, this resentment in the life of the fictional person that wrote this inventory for the book, will kill you if you're sober and you hang on to something like this. You will not stay sober. That's the experience of legions of alcoholics, they say, that have gone before us. That this is one of those things we make a decision in the third step. This is one of the things we have to face and be rid of, is these resentments in our life. Because when dealing, you know, we're shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, which for most normal people is, well, you know, they're shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Maybe they're not going to have as happy a life as they would if they didn't have that resentment. But for alcoholics, says these things are poison. You know, this stuff, these Mr. Browns, you know, if we, you know, if our only hope is in the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment, they say, is infinitely grave. That this stuff actually has the power to kill. Resentment. And we've left the booze behind. It wasn't the booze and the drugs that was doing this to me. It was all these other things. We got to get down to causes and effects. The resentments and the fears and the sex conduct in my life are the three big ones that we deal with in early inventory. And it's the ones that they looked at and they said, yeah, these are the big ones. These were guys that were living this way of life for a while before they ever wrote this book. And they had a part of what they did was this admission of character defects, this accountability to others. This was a part of what they did back in the early days of AA. They would circle up in groups like this and they would just go around and they would just say, well, this is what I have to admit to the group today. It was a way of life for them. And they really saw that out of all that experience, the things that were really killing them were these resentments and the fears in their life and their sexual conduct. And these were the things that they decided to address in the big book. So we kind of have this three-part inventory. This resentment that we write about, where we actually look at where I was to blame. We'll talk about that some more this weekend and here in just a minute, actually. And I wrote all this stuff down. Of course, you know, had a resentment against my mom. It was a really simple one. You know, she ruined my life. So it was very, you know, very simple and to the point. You know, okay, that's number one. My mom, she ruined my life. And then I could just kind of go on from there. And everybody else was kind of, you know, had, you know, varying degrees of the same kind of a thing. But you know, it was all kind of this thing. And I kind of heard all this stuff about getting outside yourself. And I was writing this fourth column, which is where we put, you know, we set all this stuff aside and say, okay, well, dealing with your mom, where were you to blame? Dealing with this boss, where were you to blame? Well, you know, I did, you know, break into their medical chest and steal all their drugs. And maybe I wasn't the best employee at the company. And you know, I got to look at all this stuff. But, you know, somehow when I was really writing that inventory and I got a chance to list all of my fears, and I honestly can say today I think it would have been easier for me to make a list of the things that I wasn't afraid of. Because I started listing my fears and I thought, well, I'm afraid I'm not going to stay sober, for sure. I was really afraid of that in early sobriety. I thought, you know, maybe this is all just going to be for nothing again. So I'm afraid to stay sober. And then I thought about, oh, I'm afraid to stay sober. I'm afraid I won't stay sober. I'm afraid to stay sober. I had a girlfriend at the time. I'd been hanging out at a kind of a low-bottom AA hall, so I had a girlfriend. So I wrote down, I wrote down that I'm afraid she's going to leave me. I'm afraid she's going to leave me. And then the next thing, I was afraid she was going to stay. You know, what does that mean? Responsibilities and I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to get a job. I'm afraid about getting a job, that I won't be able to do it, that they'll kind of discover that I'm a really, you know, eventually they'll discover that I'm a failure at life, and I'm afraid to get a job. I'm afraid, too, that I won't be successful, and I'm afraid of success. I was paralyzed by fear, and the book describes this. They say that the fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It's like this evil and corroding thread. And we all know, like, you know, you pull the thread and now the shirt's ruined. You know, it's just one thread, but, you know, the fabric of our existence is shot through with this deal. This evil and corroding thread. And they say, well, after we write this inventory and they kind of give us this way, they say, well, maybe there's a better way, this idea of trusting and relying on God. And we look at this place of this God reliance in the fifth step. And we look at our sexual conduct, and I was told there's some questions here by coincidence only, and it really is that way. The sex inventory is on 68 and 69, and they give us a list of questions on 69 in the middle of the page there. You know, we reviewed our conduct over the years past, so I was told I could go back as far as I wanted and that I could start at the very beginning with the first time I'd ever had sex or the first relationship I'd ever had and all of